Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is aired nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on illegal immigration right after this. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, incompetence, incapacity. We've now been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions in our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs, and doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs, instead of relying upon our own good common sense. That's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish, instead of being fed by all of these paid legal and professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, and you can, that's georgegordon.org. Click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we're talking about illegal immigration and what the costs of this illegal immigration are. Last time we took a look at the numbers of illegal immigrants in the country. Three sources here. Number one, the official U.S. government source. They estimate 12 million people. This is back in 2005. And they deliberately underestimate, and they're deliberately not shutting off the flow. So I'm suspicious that it's abnormally low. Second number came from Bear Stearns, 2005. Their number was about 20 million from their study. And then a Vanderbilt study came out of Tennessee, and they thought that it was more like 7 million a year. If that's the case, then we are being invaded. This is an army of invasion. It's like an army or a plague of locusts. And as a result of that, not only is it unsustainable, but the more that are flowing in, the less time that we're going to have to prepare for the imminent collapse. Because like the Titanic, and I showed you this the last time, it's already got a 300-foot hole down the side. We're not talking about saving the great ship America any more than we could be talking about saving the Titanic. What we're discussing here in the little time that's left is how many survivors will there be and how many victims. Like the Roman Empire of old, there came a tipping point when there wasn't anything that could be done that was going to save the empire. Now, it finally collapsed in 476 A.D., but if we'd have been looking at the problem in 470, and we would be in the same position that we are here in America today. The tipping point had already been passed. And there wasn't anything that was going to change the ultimate outcome, but it gave us 6 years to plan for that ultimate outcome and what are we going to do as individuals. Now, hampering today's immigration debate are our misconceptions about the so-called first great migration some 100 years ago, with which today's immigration is often compared. We envision that first great migration as a time when multitudes of Emma Lazarus's tired, poor, and wretched refuse of Europe's shores made their way from destitution to American opportunity. But that argument distorts the realities of the first great migration. Though fleeing persecution or economic stagnation in their homelands, that era's immigrants, the Jewish tailors, the seamstresses who helped to create the New York garment industry, the Italian stonemasons and bricklayers who helped build some of our greatest buildings, the German merchants and shopkeepers and artisans, all of these people from Europe brought important skills with them that fit easily into the American economy. Those waves of immigrants, many of them urban dwellers who crossed a continent and an ocean to get here, helped to supercharge the workforce at a time when the country was going through a transformative economic expansion that craved and needed new workers, especially in its cities. Now, many of these immigrants quickly found a place in the economy, participating in the workforce at a higher rate even than the native population. Their success at finding work sent many of them quickly up the economic ladder. Those who stayed in America for at least 15 years, for instance, were just as likely to own their own business as a native-born worker of the same age. Another study found that their American-born children were just as likely to be accountants, engineers, or lawyers as Americans whose families had been here for generations. What the newcomers of the Great Migration did not find here was a vast social services and welfare state. They had to rely upon their own resources or those of friends, relatives, or private, often ethnic charities, if things did not go well. This flood of immigrants, both legal and illegal, from countries with poor, ill-educated populations, has yielded a mismatch between today's immigrants and the American economy and has left many workers poorly positioned to succeed for the long term. Unlike the immigrants of 100 years ago, whose skills reflected or surpassed those of the native workforce at that time, many of today's arrivals, particularly the more than two and a half, or more than that half, who now come from Central and South America, are farm workers in their home countries who come here with little education or even basic training in blue-collar occupations like carpentry or machinery. And the article goes on to note that because so much of our legal and illegal immigrant labor is concentrated in such fringe, low-wage employment, its overall impact on our economy is extremely small. A 1997 National Academy of Sciences study estimated that immigration's net benefit to the American economy raises the average income of the native-born by only some $10 billion a year, about $120 per household. And that meager contribution is not the result of immigrants helping to build our essential industries or making us more competitive globally, but rather they merely deliver our pizzas, cut our grass, and wash our cars. Estimates by pro-immigration forces that foreign workers contribute much more to the economy, boosting annual gross domestic product by hundreds of billions of dollars, generally just tally what the immigrants earn here. And they ignore the offsetting effect that these same immigrants have on wages of the native-born workers and what it is that they're consuming here. If the benefits of the current generation of migrants are small, and if the costs are large, and if those costs are large and growing because of America's vast range of social programs and the wide advocacy network that strives to hook low-earning legal and illegal immigrants into these programs. A 1998 National Academy of Sciences study found that more than 30% of California's foreign-born were on Medicaid, including 37% of all Hispanic households, compared with 14% of native-born households. Now that's more than double. The foreign-born were more than twice as likely as the native-born to be on welfare, and their children were nearly five times as likely to be in means-tested government lunch programs. Native-born households pay for much of this, and the study found because they earn more and pay higher taxes, they are more likely to comply with tax laws. Recent immigrants, by contrast, have much lower levels of income and tax compliance. Another study estimated that only 56% of illegals in California have taxes deducted from their earnings, for instance. And the study's conclusion, immigrant families cost each native-born household in California an additional $1,200 a year in taxes. That's a net loss. Think about that for a moment. You're living in California, and you're a native-born, and you're paying your taxes and living your life, and you're buying, selling, and trading, and going to work every day and doing your thing. Right alongside of you, there is an immigrant, and he's working, and he's coming and going, and he's doing his thing. And at the end of the year, when we finish up his work and your work, you have to pay $1,200 to subsidize that fella working next to you. That's the net effect in one state, California. Now, California has about 3 million illegal immigrants. Texas, about 1.5 million, Florida, 1 million, Illinois, 500,000, New York, 500,000, Arizona, 500,000, Georgia, 500,000, New Jersey, 500,000. North Carolina, Washington have about a third of a million, a quarter of a million, and all of the other states have about 3 million people. That's 3 million illegal immigrants or illegals in their states. If it costs $1,200 in California, well, then it must cost $1,200 in the rest of the states or something close to it. Now, let's see if my little EL 1137 or 1197 G3 can work out this number. You get 12 million. And then they cost you $1,200. And it goes, oops, too big a number for me. So let me just write this down. We got 12 million. And then we got 1,200. So let's take off two zeros and we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's 12 and 1, 2, 3, 4. We'll divide that by 12. That gives us 10,000. Now we'll add on four zeros. That's $100 billion a year, which is right at what we calculated last time when we were looking at how much money is being sent overseas. Now, let's start thinking about this. First of all, they're shipping out of here about $100 billion a year, and then you have to pay $100 billion a year to support that guy here. That's $200 billion a year that you have to make up for, you know, just as an average run-of-the-mill, everyday garden variety, taxpaying citizen. And this doesn't count the cost of educating his children. We're coming to that. That's another $10,700 a year. It totals, according to the government statistics, about $30 billion a year. We don't know exactly how many of these children are in the country, but it's $10,700 to educate one of them for 1 year. And we don't know how many illegals are in the country. The government tells us 12. Bear Stearns tells us it's 20. And the college in Tennessee, what was that? I forgot the name of the college now, medical school, said that there was 7.5 million per year coming into the country, illegals. My God, if that's the case, the ship is taking on water much faster than we had originally anticipated. Now, it's true that some of it is, we don't know the answer, so I'm being conservative. I'm using the government's numbers. This is what they're telling me. And already, it's unsustainable. Using the 12 million that the government admits is here right now, and they're taking their numbers now from the census and from surveys, census and surveys. Then they go out and they take a look in our hospitals and they say, okay, well, now how many of these people are you treating in here that are citizens or non-citizens? Then they go to the schools and they say, well, how many of these children in here are citizens or non-citizens? And then they take a look at the social services. Well, how many of these are citizens and non-citizens? Then they take a look in the workforce and they keep taking these samples. And then they come back to us and they give us a number, which nearly everybody believes is understated. The 12 billion, or 12 million rather. Not only is it unsustainable, it gets worse as we progress. I go on to point out that because so much of our legal and illegal immigrant labor is concentrated in such fringe low-wage employment, these people that are coming in here, they're not able to be assimilated into the workforce. So they're working out here in the marginal jobs. They're making your beds in the Holiday Inn, and they're working in the fields. And they're being paid under the table. They're not paying taxes. They're being paid in cash under the table, and they're sending $18 billion of it to Mexico, $36 billion to China, $27 billion to Africa, and then it's spread around the rest of the world, another $25 billion. That's $100 billion a year that's being siphoned off. And it's probably good for the lettuce grower in Salinas, but you have to pick up the slack. You may be buying cheap lettuce in the grocery store, but you're paying for it when you pay your taxes. You're paying for it with inflation. We're not getting away with it. We're all paying for it. Now, immigration's bottom line has shifted so sharply that in a high immigration state like California, native-born residents are paying up to 10 times more in state and local taxes than the immigrants generate in economic benefits. Moreover, the cost is only likely to grow as the foreign-born population, which has already mushroomed from about 9% of the population when the NAS studies were done in the late 1990s, to about 12% today, and it keeps growing. And citizens in more and more places will feel the bite. As immigrants move beyond their traditional settling places from 1990 to 2005, the number of states in which these immigrants make up at least 5% of the population nearly doubled from 17 to 29 states, like Arkansas, South Dakota, South Carolina, and Georgia seeing the most growth. This sharp turnaround since the 1970s, when immigrants were less likely to be using the social programs of the Great Society than the native-born population, suggests that welfare and other social programs are a magnet drawing certain types of immigrants, such as non-working women, children, and the elderly, and keeping them here when they run into difficulty. So these aren't people that are working and producing. These are people that are coming here for the express purpose of getting the social and welfare benefits. Now, let's suppose that you are a legal immigrant. And then you come here to the United States, and you're making more money on welfare in the United States than you have ever made or ever dreamed of making in your home country. For instance, in Mexico, to give you an illustration, the average wage down there is about $5 a day. It's down from 9 before the economic collapse. It's now down to $5 a day. Well, $5 a day times 30 days in a month is $150 a month. The welfare benefits here in this country are way more than $150 a month. I don't know exactly what they are, but, you know, people live on welfare. They live poorly by our standards, but they live in this country on welfare. These people can come here and retire. They don't need to come here and work. That's the legals. Now, the illegals have to work. They can't go down and sign up for WIC or food stamps and stuff like that. They're the ones that go out and work, and they work for $2 or $3 an hour. Yeah, two or three. Now, those are the ones that can't work anywhere else, and so the guy that hires them is cheating. He's supposed to be paying people minimum wage, $7 an hour, but he doesn't. He only pays these guys $2 or $3 an hour. And they work 8 or 10 hours at $2, and they make $20 or $25 a day, five times what they would make in Mexico. And listen to this. If you think that living costs, or at least food costs, are any less, we've got a world economy now. And the price of rice around the world is just about the same everywhere. The guy that's growing rice in Thailand sells his rice at the same price he could get for it in San Francisco, because if the guy in Thailand doesn't pay him that San Francisco price, he ships it to San Francisco. The people that really take it in the shorts around the world are the people that are making $2 to $5 a day. And then those people have to live and pay the same prices for food that you and I pay here. I mean, that's the reality of life around the world. Now, when they come here to the States and they work, you can see why it's all downhill for them and why that's a magnet to draw them in. The social welfare state pays them better not to work here. And if they do work here, they make five times more. If they don't work here, they probably make 10 or 15 times more than they would in their native lands. In fact, it's so good that once people retire on Social Security, they leave the United States and go back to Mexico or back to Gambia or back to Nigeria, back to Eastern Europe, and retire on Social Security, where living costs are one-tenth what they are here, and they retire in the lap of luxury. And all of it's being paid for now by the American taxpayer. These people are not working and producing and paying their own way. That's what the bottom line is. We are told that they do, but you're not getting all the facts and figures. So they're telling you that, yeah, the guy comes here and he pays taxes, but what they're not telling you is that, hey, this guy is consuming the benefits that go along with it right here. When people send their children to school, when they go to the hospital, when they use your public parks, when they're driving on your roads, when they are living in your urban sprawl, when there is a police force that protects them, a judicial system that protects them, a water and sanitation system. You mean the mere fact that there's running water and that there's a toilet that works costs money. The infrastructure that's here costs money, and it has to be maintained. Now, if you have infrastructure and 100 people are paying in and they're all supporting it, you know, and everybody's paying in his fair share, that's fine. But if half the people are paying in and half the people aren't, well, then half the people that are paying in have to pay twice as much to maintain it. That's the bottom line to that. Now, almost certainly, immigrants' participation in our social welfare programs will increase over time because so many are destined to struggle in our workforce. Despite our cherished view of immigrants as rapidly climbing the economic ladder, more and more of the new arrivals and their children face a lifetime of economic disadvantage because they arrive here with low levels of education and very few work skills, shortcomings that are not easily overcome. Now, I would strongly suggest you read the entire article, as this is a must-read. Putting all of this in perspective, read the March 2003 report from the Center for Immigration Studies. And then the title of it is Back Where We Started, An Examination of Trends in Immigrant Welfare Use Since Welfare Reform by Charles A. Camerota. And he notes in the article, he says, the primary finding of this report is that welfare use by immigrant households remains much higher than that of the natives. However, the mix of programs used by immigrants and natives, for that matter, has changed significantly since 1996. Use of TANF and food stamps has declined significantly among the foreign-born since 1996, while Medicaid use has risen somewhat. The enormous and growing cost of Medicaid means that there has likely been little or no savings for taxpayers. This is especially true when we consider the increase of 750,000 additional immigrant households using welfare programs. Immigrant households account for 18% of all households using the welfare system, and that's up from just 14% in 1996. So, in the most important sense, welfare reform with regard to immigrants has failed. Or, at the least, it has not generated the kind of savings for taxpayers that its proponents had hoped it would. Immigrant welfare use remains high, and they comprise a growing share of the welfare caseload, mainly because a very large share have little education, and the American economy offers very little opportunities to such workers. So if the welfare reform program that was initiated by the Clinton administration in the 1990s, we were told, hey, this is taking people off welfare. It took the Native American population off welfare and then replaced it with the immigrants' families on welfare, to where today it's higher than it was in the 1990s. Now, in addition to that, about one half of the people in the world earn less than $5 a day. That's 3.5 billion people. Every one of those people wants to come to the United States or Great Britain, Canada, or Australia. Now, at least the Canadians are on top of it to this degree. When you immigrate to Canada, they require that you show that you're able to feed, clothe, and house yourself. You've got to show that you've got a certain amount of economic resources before they'll let you immigrate. Now, here in the United States, we more than likely have some form of minimum standards, but that doesn't help us with all of the illegals that come into the country. And every time an illegal comes into the country and brings any children with him or a wife, then the children go to public schools, and the public schools over here then have to pay $10,700 to educate the child. Get this. If an illegal immigrant comes into the country and he has two children, and if he works for minimum wage, and he gets paid the whole $7 an hour, 7 times 2,000 hours in a year is $14,000, which is about $6,000 below the poverty limit. If he files a tax return and reports that he made $14,000, he will receive a check from the government to make up the difference to bring him up to the poverty line. And the two children that he has in school cost $20,000 to educate. So he gets a check from the government because he's under the poverty line, and it costs $20,000 to educate the kid. So that's $26,000, which is a net loss. How much tax is deducted from a guy that's making $14,000 a year? He pays a Social Security tax, and that's $7 billion a year from all these immigrants combined. So there's the numbers, and that's what it's costing you. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. We've got more to come, so hang on. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then we invite you to go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, talking about illegal immigration, we're talking about the costs of it. Last program, we talked about the numbers that were involved. Now we're taking a look at, well, what are the costs that we're dealing with here? And the bottom line is that all of the immigrants, legal and illegal, use welfare more than the natives. Uneducated migrants use welfare even more. And if illegal immigrants are legalized through amnesty, they will use twice as much welfare as they're currently using. The report also notes that immigrants from different countries or regions use more or less welfare than others, although this probably has to do more with the average education levels of the immigrants from those countries or regions. Here's a little blurb for you here. Let's suppose that you've got a pregnant woman from Venezuela. She times the delivery of her baby so that it'll be born in the United States. She buys an airline ticket from Caracas to Miami. When she comes to the United States, she can stay here for 6 months. Now, when the baby is about to be delivered, she runs over to the hospital's ER, where American law requires that she be admitted and the baby born. This gives the mother an anchor baby in the United States. The baby now is an American citizen. Why we would do that, I'm not quite sure, but we do. So with this American baby, you can't deport the American baby, so the mother has to stay here to take care of it, doesn't she? Now, while she's here in the United States with her American baby, now she wants to bring her husband here. So he applies for resident status because his wife and baby, who is an American citizen, are here in the United States, and so he's admitted. Now, they've got 4 or 5 more children down in Venezuela, so they all file for immigrant status because, after all, the mother and father are here in the country, and so we'd like to have all of our family here, and so now they've got all the family here. Now, you sit there and say, well, how can that be? Well, that's the way it is. I didn't make it that way. I'm just here to report it. Oh, and one more thing. The baby that's delivered in the Miami hospital, if she doesn't pay for it, the hospital doesn't take it in the shorts. The hospital gets paid by the state of Florida. So all that she's out is the airplane ticket from Caracas to Miami, and there's the beginning of the new immigrants to the United States. And those are legal immigrants. We're not talking about people running across the border or storming the border crossing. That's a deal that's already written into the law, and there's millions of those people that know that. Hell, they're taking advantage of it and coming here. Now, given the large numbers of immigrants currently in the United States, one of the more discouraging aspects of the study was that welfare use over time. When you take a look here at the use of welfare in the country, in 1996 through 2001, when you look at Mexico, the Caribbean nations, Central America, South America, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, East Asia, South Asia, the Sub-Saharan Africa, Western Europe, and Canada. And if you looked at Canada and you said the percentage of immigrant households using welfare in 2001 and 1996 by country and region, if you looked at Canada, it was 11% in 1996, and it went down to 6% today. So the Canadians that come into the country, and they're using less welfare on average today than they did in 1996. But if you take a look at Mexico, it's up 1%. The other countries that you look at here are all up by a percentage point or two. So the percentage of immigrant households using welfare goes up over time. And so figure 5 shows the percentage of immigrant households using at least one major welfare program based on how long the household has lived here. Consistent with previous research, welfare use actually increases significantly with the duration of the stay in the United States for at least 20 years after their arrival. Even immigrant households headed by someone who came to the country more than 20 years ago, the use of welfare programs at a significantly higher rate than the natives. In 2001, almost 21% of these longtime residents used welfare, compared to less than 15% of the natives. And this is true even though immigrants who arrived more than 20 years ago are on average much older than the average native. And to some extent, assimilation for many immigrants means assimilation into the welfare system. This is the case both for immigrants in general and for legal immigrants. Bob Brown notes in a guest opinion article in the Billings Gazette in Montana, Montana can plan ahead for Hispanic population wave. As the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman noted, poorly educated Mexican immigrants increase the supply of less skilled labor, driving down the wages of less skilled Americans. Ranking 45th among the states in per capita income, Montanans need to realize that they could soon be competing for their jobs with undocumented immigrants. That's according to the Pew Hispanic Center. Undocumented immigrants currently make up 20%, or 27% rather, of the national workforce of drywall and ceiling tile installers, 21% of roofers, 17% of cleaning and maintenance workers, and 11% of food preparation and service workers. Okay, now let's think about that for a second. These people aren't picking lettuce now. These people here represent 27% rather, of the national workforce of drywall and ceiling tile installers. Now, drywall, you know, drywall contractors come in and they put that drywall on and they put up ceiling tiles and they mud it and then they sand it. They prepare your walls. Well, now, we used to do that in this country. I can remember hiring, when I was in the contracting business, we were hiring drywall contractors, and all the people that worked for them were white, WASP, Anglo-Saxon. At least they were Americans. And now a fourth of them are Hispanic. Now, 17% of cleaning and maintenance workers, okay, now those are the people that work in the janitorial services or they're working in the motels and hotels, and they're cleaning up in the restaurants and things like that. and 11% of food preparation and service workers, the people that are working in the kitchens and washing the dishes and preparing the food that goes out there on the buffets and things like that. Now, it was in this country that the blacks held those positions. Now, what this does is, here in America, we have about a 22% unemployment rate among blacks. So when the Hispanics come in from Central America or Mexico or South America, they have to have some place to work. So they're going to work, since they're unskilled, in the lowest skilled jobs that they can get, which is the food preparation, maintenance and cleaning workers, and roofers, and drywall and ceiling tile installers. You know, the grunt work out here in the society. The work that nobody else wants to do. Remember? Okay. Well, now the lowest skilled workers in America, the natives that were born here, they have to compete with those guys. And what's worse, many of the big employers like Tyson Foods, you know, the chicken giant, and the pig butchers, you know, the big meat packing plants, Swift, Armor. Well, they're hiring these people. And that's because these people will come in here and they will work at that labor, do that job, and they'll do it for less money than the Americans. And so, therefore, the Americans get thrown on welfare or unemployment, or a combination of the two. Now, you got 12 million of these guys in the country, and you got about 12 million people unemployed in this country. In fact, I think it's a little less than that, around 8 or 9. We don't need any of that labor here, and all of this labor that's being used by these people is a job that some American doesn't have. I mean, that's what the bottom line is. Just stop and think now for a second. If there's a Mexican out here working on that job, if he wasn't here, well, then they'd have to hire somebody else. Now, the welfare state is such that Americans don't want to work because they can make more money on welfare than they can working. So when I was a youngster, you know, we used to calculate that. I would leave work in the woods, and you only work in the woods about 5 months a year, but you could draw unemployment insurance for 13 weeks. It wasn't that I couldn't work doing something else. It's that, why would I want to go work milking cows for $300 a month when I can get for the next 3 months and then another extension for 13 weeks when I show hardship, 26 weeks, that's 6 months. When I can draw unemployment insurance, which is $55 a week, tax-free, then I can get $220 a month tax-free, and if I work, I get $300 a month, but I only take home about $200 of it because I got to pay $100 in taxes. So it's more profitable not to work than it is to work. And that's assuming that I wouldn't be willing to take that little extra cut in pay. In other words, $220 from $300 is only $80. $80. Even if I would make $25 more money, would I really want to go work for 167 hours for the month and only get paid an extra $25 for it? And the answer to that is no. As it turned out, unemployment paid better than working. But even if it didn't pay better than working, I would have taken the pay cut anyway. So now what this boils down to, when I was a youngster working in the woods, I worked 5 months in the woods and paid in my unemployment. I got 13 weeks because I was entitled to it when they laid me off. And then when I came in and said, there's no work out there available working at my employment, which is what? Working in the woods, which is seasonal work. You can't work in the wintertime when it's raining. So you're only going to work May, June, July, August, and September, 5 months. And then you're going to be on unemployment in October, November, December, January, February, March. And so I can only get unemployment insurance for 6 months, so I'm going to be off work for a month. I take that 1 month and go to Mexico on vacation, and then I'm drawing unemployment for 6 months, which is equal to what I'm making when I'm working, when I would be working, you know, on a dairy. And so now I'm working in the woods doing what I want to do, and I get 7 months off, six of them paid and 1 month unpaid. Well, now, I was a native, and I could figure that out. Now, how about these people from South America? Can they figure that out? Boys and girls, they've already got it scoped out, and you're paying the bill. Now, the cost to our country of coping with this great escape are overwhelming. A minimum of 12 million, and perhaps as many as 20 million Hispanics, are in our country illegally. Court decisions and the selective enforcement of our laws have allowed many of them here to remain here and receive the benefits of U.S. citizens. These include cash payments, food stamps, free medical care, and all other tax-supported public services. Now, the crime rate among undocumented Mexican immigrants is 3 to 4 times the national average. The cost of schooling, health care, welfare, Social Security, and prisons, plus the additional pressure on land, water, and power resources, greatly exceeds the taxes that the undocumented immigrants pay. Now, a Rice University study recently calculated that in 2006, the net annual cost of legal and illegal immigration will add up to $108 billion. The late Nobel economist Milton Friedman observed, "It's just obvious that you can't have free immigration and wealth and the welfare state at the same time. But as our national debt mounts and future Americans face a crushing burden, we continue to try to defy the obvious." So let's see here what we've got. It's the cost of school. School is $10,700 per student per year. Healthcare. Anytime you walk into a hospital, nobody asks when you got your hand cut off and you're bleeding, nobody says, "Hey, are you documented or undocumented?" They take you in because that's what the law requires. Welfare. Now, they can't get welfare. And if they walk in and say, "Hey, we want welfare," they can't get it. Social Security and prisons. And listen, prison costs $35,000 a year. And remember, the crime rate among undocumented Mexican immigrants is 3 to 4 times the national average. 3 to 4 times. So when these people get locked up, they have to be paid for. Prison costs money. And when these guys get locked up, you're paying for it. Plus the additional pressures on land, water, and power resources. Oh, wait a minute. These people are using water, power, and land. And all of that has to be paid for. That's a part of your infrastructure that we all pay for. You know, we're all paid for. It's like your national parks. The national parks are there whether you use them or don't, but everybody pays for them. And don't think now for a moment that these big corporations out here are paying a dime. George Soros and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are not paying for any of it. And there are corporations like Microsoft and the Buffett Investment Empire, what do they call that, Berkshire Hathaway, they're not paying for it. It's the consumer that pays for all of this. The guy that actually goes into McDonald's and puts his money on the counter and walks out with lunch, that's the guy that paid for it. And when he bought that hamburger, he paid 257 hidden taxes. All of the taxes that all of the merchants and vendors had to pay have been bundled into all of the products that were ultimately sold to you in that McDonald's burger, and you paid it. So from that point of view, when the immigrant, whether he's legal or illegal, when he buys something here, he's paying tax. He's paying his share. Now here's what our problem is. When you go in and buy that McDonald's big burger, you pay the tax, but you don't collect the benefit when you're delivering this free anchor baby in the hospital. The immigrant goes in, he pays his tax when he eats the hamburger. Then he goes down to the hospital, and he collects a $10,000 anchor baby. Or he sends his kid to public school, and he gets $10,700 worth of services that you have to pay for. So you pay, and you don't collect. He pays, and he collects, and when he collects $3 for every dollar that he pays in. And you subsidize the other two. And that's not being done by the corporations or George Soros or Bill Gates. Now, you can say, as recently reported in the Los Angeles Times in an article by Jordan Rao, governor to seek insurance for all children. In Sacramento, the article reads like this. It says, "Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger will propose that all California children, including those in the state illegally, be guaranteed medical insurance as part of the health care overhaul that he intends to unveil next week, according to officials familiar with the plan. If enacted by the legislature, his proposal would affect about 763,000 children who now lack insurance. Although the administration has not revealed details of how it would pay for such a program, officials estimate that extending insurance to all children would cost the state as much as $400 million a year, and that would be a small piece of Schwarzenegger's stated goal, and that is to ensure medical coverage for all of the 6.5 million Californians who now have none. And experts say that that could cost upwards of $10 billion a year." So let's write $400 million down here on the side, because California right now has a $19 billion budget deficit. And as we proceed along here, we're going to see that that $19 billion budget deficit is just about the same amount as the cost of those 3 million illegal aliens that are living in and living off of the largesse of the state of California. 3 million, and it's costing them $19 billion a year. You know, all told, all costs included. However, as noted in an article by Edward Sifuentes in the North County Times, California's illegal aliens cost taxpayers $9 billion a year, a bottom of the range number. Californians are already paying a hefty price for all of their illegal alien guests. Add in another $10 billion more, and that's now $19 billion. If one-third of Californians pay taxes, that's about $2,000 per taxpayer. So Arnold Schwarzenegger, there's your $19 billion. But I've got a little sidelight I'd like to bring to your attention. Arnold Schwarzenegger is an immigrant from Austria. His father was a Nazi, and Arnie was a member of the Hitler Youth. Has it ever occurred to anybody or maybe just us conspiracy theorists, that Arnie is in reality a hypocrite. He is a secret Nazi who has now become governor of the largest state in the United States, and that his agenda, his real goal in life, is to bankrupt the state, to bankrupt America, to destroy the nation that destroyed his nation? I just thought I'd throw that one out there. You know, the people who are in power here in the United States are smarter than I am. Governor Schwarzenegger has better sources of information than I have. And I'm going to presume that since he's a multimillionaire movie actor, that he is much smarter than I am, and that he more than likely has better sources of information than I have, and that he knows that this cost of $19 billion a year from these aliens, illegal aliens in the state, is in fact equal to the $19 billion a year that they have as a shortfall in their budget. That I'm not the only guy that knows that. I'm not the only guy that has seen that. I'm not the only guy that can add that up. And I'm taking this off the internet. I'm taking these numbers right out of the government. It's the United States government. It's our departments here that are reporting this. And I think they're under-reporting the problem, under-reporting the numbers. But these numbers, if we take them, tell us the answer to our budget woes. It tells us the answer to our unemployment. If in fact, these people number 12 million in the country, and if in fact we've got 8 or 9 million Americans unemployed, doesn't that tell you that if you got rid of the illegal aliens, you'd have 8 or 9 million more jobs, wouldn't you? Now, when America was booming, I could see having some extra help come in, but now that we're not booming, you know, three times in our history, 1930, 46, and 54, our president said, we're going to shut the border off. You can't come in here and work until Americans are back to work. I just thought I'd throw that out there for you. Hey, with that, I've got to close this program off for today. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.